Hello and welcome to episode 150 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. We're here today with Dr. Paul Locke, Associate Professor at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health in the Departments of Environmental Health and Engineering and Health Policy and Management. Paul is also an attorney admitted to practice law in the District of Columbia and New York, and before the Supreme Court of the United States and the United States District Court for the Southern District of New York. Professor Locke is a law professor at Lewis and Clark Law School, the former deputy director of the Trust for America's Health, a former board of director for the National Council on Radiation Protection and Measurements, affiliated with the Center for Alternatives to Animal Testing. He's on the board of National Academy of Sciences Institute for Laboratory Animal Research, and has recently been an expert witness in a Canadian trial. Paul, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for asking me to do this, Jordan. This is exciting.
All right. So the first question I'd like to ask is, what are you currently doing or what have you ever done to advance the public interest and why?
Well, that's a really good question. I think I'm lucky in my job because as a faculty member at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and in the Department of Environmental Health and Engineering, we have a lot of encouragement to really go out and work with the public. So my involvement with the public is on several levels. First, I'm involved a lot with the U.S. National Academy of Sciences. I sit on quite a few of their boards and on their study committees. So the Academy generally brings together experts on a number of topics. And you, as an expert, you serve pro bono, which means for free. They do reimburse you for your travel. But you work with other experts over a period of 14 months to 24 months to put together reports that improve the public in many ways. So, for example, the latest report that I did was I was with a group of other experts, and we looked at lessons learned from the Fukushima natural disaster and the, of course, loss of the Fukushima Fukushima nuclear power plants and the subsequent radiation. And we looked at that in terms of how it could improve the safety and security of U.S. power plants. So that was a very interesting project. We got to actually go to Fukushima. We went there probably about 12 or 14 months after the Fukushima accident, and we saw the facility. We toured the facility, got suited up, toured the facility. We talked a lot about what facility could have done differently, what happened at the facility. It's not easy to figure out what happened at that facility. And then we translated that into some definite recommendations that U.S. nuclear power plants could use.
So in light of going to Fukushima, how do you feel about nuclear power, especially within the context of global warming, our stubborn reliance on fossil fuels, which contributes to this global warming climate change phenomena, and our interest in alternative energies? We do have this perpetual renewable resource that can generate a lot of energy without creating a carbon footprint. What are you thinking about nuclear power within the context of the disaster and also global warming?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and we, of course, need several hours to explore that fully. But let me give you my personal opinion, and let me emphasize this is my personal opinion. This is not an opinion that is something that I, in a way, I don't represent Johns Hopkins saying this. I don't represent the National Academy saying this. My personal opinion is that we need to have nuclear power as a source of energy going forward for many reasons. One of the major ones is because we need to do something about climate change. And the nuclear technologies we have, especially the new ones coming on, offer great promise to provide energy that is not going to contribute to the carbon burden that is now in the environment. And I say that after having gone to Fukushima and seen Fukushima. I do want to point out something that is really interesting, because another area I work in is radiation risk communication. And radiation risk communication has taught me that people have fears about radiation. Those fears aren't irrational at all, because radiation can harm you. By the way, radiation can also help you quite a bit. If you have certain diseases, certain types of cancers, radiation is the treatment of choice. So it's kind of a mixed blessing. But we, I think, as public health professionals and experts, need to do a lot better job of explaining to people both the benefits and risks of radiation. Nuclear power plants, on the whole, have an extremely strong operating record, especially in the United States, especially after Three Mile Island.
So what about the difference between fission and fusion power? Historically, nuclear power plants have been powered off of fission reactions, but fusion reactions don't tend to create, I think in theory, wouldn't create nuclear radioactive waste, but instead, as a byproduct of their reaction, it'd create only steam. But I've also heard that, and there may be molten salt and different. So how do you reconcile fission versus fusion?
Well, that's not a question I have the expertise to answer. Mm-hmm. But I have asked people about that, and what they've told me, and this is something you might want to discuss with another expert, is that fusion is something that's going to be done very, very far in the future. Hmm. Right now, fusion is an interesting theory, but as you know, taking something from theory to reality is not easy. The other part of that question you asked, though, is what about these new reactor designs? You mentioned molten salt. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm not an expert in this, but I think one of the things to keep in mind is that nuclear engineers and people who build nuclear power plants have thought a lot about how to make the process of creating energy from fission a lot safer from the perspective of avoiding meltdowns, mm-hmm. From creating byproducts that could be used for nefarious purposes. And a lot of these new designs do that.
Because right now, nuclear power plants are essentially steam engines. They're tea kettles. What they do is you use a reaction to create a lot of heat that boils water, and the steam pushes cylinders around magnets. That's basically what a nuclear power plant is, right? It's not too complicated.
Well, it's actually quite complicated on doing that, but perhaps the general theory that you're talking about is accurate. But don't ever, I think, it's important not to discount too much how difficult it is to make that happen with an atom.
Right.
And by the way, that's not a bad way to provide power. We've been providing power that way for years and years and years. Mm-hmm. So the trick is in creating a design that creates the least amount of waste that is safe and is secure. Mm-hmm. And that's really what we need to focus on.
So you are an associate professor of environmental health, but formerly you were you currently are a law professor, you currently are an attorney, and formerly you were a corporate attorney. How is it that one makes a transition from corporate law and Wall Street in New York City to becoming quite interested and passionate about radioactivity?
Well, that's really interesting you mentioned that. Actually, you're right. My first job was on Wall Street. My first employment was in the World Trade Center, One World Trade Center.
Huh.
That's where my office was. And I did do corporate securities transactions, and that in some ways was a very rewarding practice. But what I learned is that it really was great for other people, but not for me. Mm-hmm. I wanted something different, and what happened to me was I really decided that while it's important to have people who are good at representing the business community, it's also important to have people who are good at understanding public interest.
Right.
So in my career, about midway through my career, I did make a switch. I will tell you, it was very difficult. It was not easy to do for many reasons. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons it's not easy to do is because you are basically changing your whole life over. And you're going from a community of people that you worked with and respected and know to a new community of people. So that did take some adjustment. However, it's been great. While I was doing private practice in corporate law, mm-hmm. there was a chance to do pro bono, and a lot of and a lot of lawyers do, and they're very good at it. Mm-hmm. But now I get to do even more pro bono, and my job itself is much more revolving around public interest and the public's health.
The entire trip to Fukushima, in fact, was pro bono.
All my time was contributed. Yeah.
So and then you continue to do that. Okay, so on the Canadian trial, for instance. So somehow you were successful doing corporate securities in New York, and you worked for, I think, three law firms, and then you ended up saying, well, what really interests me is a public interest, and I'd like to do that in a little bit of a different light. You ended up getting a DRPH. How did you feel, first of all, why public health? How did that eventually take you down the road to nuclear power and animal testing? And then, well, let's start with that.
So why public health? Well, I had always been interested in science, and actually I wanted to go into public health when I first got out of undergraduate. Mm-hmm. But at the time, there a president had been elected who people believed was not going to invest in public health. Mm-hmm. His name, by the way, was Ronald Reagan. When Reagan was elected, I decided I would go to law school because it would might be a better way for me to advance my career. But later on...
ended up being quite friendly to the career track that you ended up pursuing.
Well, he
deregulated Wall Street, didn't he?
He did, although he actually deregulated something, an area I was working on, and made me obsolete in that way.
Oh.
So it was interesting.
Huh.
The eventual push was that after I ended up doing that Wall Street work, I practiced environmental law, and then I got a lot more interested in the science, so I was able to come back to Johns Hopkins, right here at Johns Hopkins, and get my doctoral degree.
Mm-hmm.
And then an opportunity presented itself to work at the Pew Environmental Health Commission,
yeah,
which you mentioned. And the Pew Environmental Health Commission was all about looking at the environmental health system we have in this country and figuring out how to make it better.
Mm-hmm.
So we had some recommendations about how to do that. For example, one of the things we recommended is public health tracking.
Mm-hmm.
We learned when we were doing work with the Pew Environmental Health Commission that most people think that the government has a good handle on what goes into your body, what your exposures are, and what comes out.
Uh-huh.
The opposite is true. So we recommended that CDC...
government doesn't know what's going into your body.
No, the government doesn't, and in fact...
Do consumers know what's going into their body?
I think that most people don't have a very good idea. You know, because when you think about it, it's very complex.
And when you think I'm eating a piece of bread, you're actually eating a ton of sugar, a ton of salt, a ton of other things, not just grain, right? Is that what you're saying, are additives into processed food?
Well, no food is simple. No exposure is simple.
Mm-hmm.
So, sure, food products have a lot of different things in them, some of which are very good for you, some of which might not be so good for you,
mm-hmm,
some of which are going to be good for you depending on the dose you
right
get. But there are other things, ways we get exposed. We get exposed to things through air. We get
mm-hmm
exposed to things through water.
Mm-hmm.
We get exposed to things dermally, you know, creams and lotions and things we use, cosmetics we use. So Americans think that the government knows how all these things affect us. They don't. So what we suggested was that the government establish a tracking program to start to learn these things. And in fact, our Centers for Disease Control now has a very mature tracking program. I want to give them kudos for doing that and keeping it going, because the Pew Environmental Health Commission now is almost 15, 16 years ago.
So you said, I want to change, leave finance, go into public health. I think that people don't really understand what the environmental impact is on their health, and that's something that's interesting to me.
Well, the issue about understanding what goes into environmental health and
mm-hmm
what goes into people's body is something that emerged from working on the Pew Environmental Health Commission. And the commission,
which you were doing as an attorney prior to...
No, I was doing that after I got my doctoral degree.
Okay.
And that helped me transition to Hopkins.
Okay.
So at Hopkins, I actually do pursue two very different substantive areas, and I'm lucky that Hopkins gives me the latitude to do that.
Mm-hmm.
One is, as you discussed, radiation, and
mm-hmm
we've been talking about nuclear power, but actually I started working on radiation issues associated with indoor radon,
mm-hmm,
which is still a problem. There's a lot of naturally occurring radiation that can build up in people's homes, and at a certain level, it becomes something you need to deal with.
And now, I know that in your classes, you teach about in the early part of the 20th century, there were paints made with radioactive materials. What sort of sources might there be for radioactive radon in people's homes today?
Radon itself comes from granite, mostly, and soil. It's naturally occurring.
Hmm.
So what happens is, if you think of, this is greatly simplified, but if you look at EPA's website,
mm-hmm,
EPA.gov/radon, they have a lot of information on this. And
mm-hmm
some states also have information on this, too. Radon seeps into the home because the home basically can be a negative pressure vessel,
mm-hmm,
and it can build up to dangerous levels. So the EPA cannot regulate radon directly, but it's set an action level. And everyone in this country should be testing their homes.
Uh-huh.
And everyone in this country, if the level they find in their home is at or above the action level, they should fix it.
How do you
easy
create a positive pressure system or flush it out?
Well, I mean, you fix radon the same way you fix a lot of other things that break in your house. If you're a really good person and a do-it-yourselfer, you might be able to do it yourself. I'm not.
Is there something that can absorb radon?
No. Mostly what I would recommend people do is call a certified radon professional. Mm-hmm. And the certified radon professional can come in, can evaluate your home, and will put in a system mm-hmm. that removes the radon and emits it to the environment where above the house where it will dissipate. So basically that system involves sucking the radon out from underneath the house and bringing it up through the house and then venting it out. It's called a sub-slab depressurization. That's a fancy way for it.
Oh my
it's
God.
It's not an expensive fix compared to most of the homes, especially most of the homes in the DMV, DC, Maryland, Virginia area. So that's how I got started with radon. But then I also worked on radiation risk assessment. I also worked on disposal of high-level nuclear waste. I've been to several high-level nuclear waste disposal sites.
Yucca Mountain and was that ever used?
Yucca was never used, but there is high-level radioactive waste at Hanford in Washington, at Savannah River, which is in South Carolina, I believe, but it might be on the South Carolina-Georgia border. I can't quite remember. And at Idaho Falls in Idaho.
Hmm.
So I've been to all those places, and I've worked on National Academy reports on those.
But is there any deleterious effect to the population's health surrounding that area?
I don't know about the studies of that area. But
a lot of people's objections to nuclear power is, where are we going to dispose of the waste?
Mm-hmm.
And the objection is, well, just like we don't want to have Guantanamo Bay terrorist inmates in our backyard in our state, and no governor wants to take them. Similarly, no elected officials want to say, well, you know what, we're willing to take nuclear radioactive waste, which may be harmful to our population, and put it in our state. So the question is, since it's in three spots, have there been any negative consequences to the population's health?
Well, first, I would want to just state that I would not equate nuclear waste to terrorists, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I would just want to back away from that a little bit. And I want to tell you that if you look at the scientific literature, there are ways to treat and store nuclear waste. Now, that being said, mm-hmm. nuclear waste lasts a long time.
Uh-huh.
And if you ask me what's going to happen to the nuclear waste in 1,000, 10,000 years, I can't answer that question. No one can.
Mm-hmm.
What I can tell you is, knowing about what I know about technology, we can do a very, very good technological job
mm-hmm.
with disposal of nuclear waste. We already have, many people don't know this, we already have one facility in this country that deals with radioactive waste called it's in Carlsbad, New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
We do need another one, I think you're right, to actually contain the waste, store the waste from nuclear power facilities. Right now, that waste is well stored and carefully stored at the facilities itself.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be nice to have a central storage facility. But that technology has been studied,
mm-hmm.
and I think something could be built that would be successful. Other countries have done it. If other countries have done it, I think we can do it too. I don't think the technology is all that new or noteworthy.
Now, you mentioned you have two research interests.
Yes.
So moving on from radiation, let's talk about testing on animals.
Right. So, you know, I think one of the fun things and one of the really interesting things about being at Johns Hopkins, and one of the ways you can really contribute, is by bringing your expertise and your passion to bear on very controversial issues. And obviously radiation is one of those.
Mm-hmm.
Another area that's very controversial in society is the use of animals in cosmetics testing,
mm-hmm.
in chemicals testing, toxicity mm-hmm. testing, in pharmaceutical testing, and in biomedical research.
And they're maiming these animals and killing these animals?
No. The animals are sacrificed at the end of many experiments, but the idea of maiming an animal in pursuit of science, I would say, would not be a best practice under biomedical research as I understand it.
Right. So what is it that you're... Well, first of all, how did you get involved? Do you have a dog?
No. in fact, I am probably the least likely candidate to actually have gotten involved in this.
Mm-hmm.
I come from a family of people who are allergic to dogs and cats.
Are you vegetarian?
Yes, I am a vegetarian. But I've been a vegetarian now for about 10 years.
Huh.
But my own family history, I don't have any family history of companion animals. However, what I'm really passionate about is several things. First of all, I think from an ethical standpoint, we as humans... Mm-hmm. have to put ourselves in a position where we're making very strong ethical judgments about humans and non-humans. Second, from a scientific standpoint, we've got to use the best science available to us. And what I've learned through my contact at Hopkins, especially through our Center for Alternatives to Animal Testing, where, as you mentioned, I'm affiliated, is that very often we can develop science and use scientific methods that don't involve animals that give us very revealing and interesting scientific information. So that's really what I try to do. The way we describe this in science is there's this philosophy called the three R's. And the three R's are replacement, reduction, and refinement. So going in reverse order, if you have to use animals in an experiment, first of all, you recognize that that's a societal privilege, and you make sure the animals are not exposed to pain and distress unless it's absolutely necessary. That's refinement. Then you also look at your scientific research to make sure you reduce the animals that you're using as much as possible. And not only do you reduce the number of animals you're using, but you also think about using animals that are lower on the phylogenetic scale. So, for example, if you think, okay, I should maybe do this research in dogs, you should be thinking about doing the research in mice. If you're doing the research in mice, you should be thinking about whether you can do the research in worms, and so forth down. So, you know, you use the animal that is lowest on the scale that will give you the scientific information you need. And then the third area where I work the most is in replacement, where you use animals that are, you use techniques that don't involve animals, or, as I mentioned earlier, you use animals that are lower on the scale. That's called relative replacement. Absolute replacement is you use non-animal systems. So a non-animal system would be something like an organ on the chip, which we're working on at places like Hopkins and other places, where you actually can mimic the function of an organ on a little chip. And you can study toxicity using that without having to expose animals
to compounds. So is this like an organ that's virtual, like inside a computer game? Or is this one of those instances where they grew an ear in a Petri dish?
It's not growing an ear in a Petri dish. It's more like a virtual organ. And the best way I can describe this is... if you think about
Code.
It's not necessarily computer code, or you can study things like that. It's actually a system. It's an engineered system. So think about when I say organ on a chip, think about a computer chip, what that looks like. If you could open, you used to be able to open these computers that we have on our desk now. If you could open one of those and pull out a circuit board, it might look like that circuit board.
So no biological matter, no tissues there.
You might grow tissue on some of them, but the tissue would come from cells. You would grow the cells as tissue. By the way, growing tissue is very complex. It's not easy to grow tissue. One thing I would suggest to your listeners is that they might want to go to the internet and just put the words organ on a chip in their search box. They'll come up with some good pictures that will be able to describe this much better than my verbal description could be.
Sounds like a very dynamic, fast, rapidly changing field where new technology, organ on a chip, doesn't sound like something that might have been around 20 years ago.
No, in fact, it is a really rapidly developing field, and it's very exciting to be in this. And one of the areas that I do work in that is really very, very, I think, cutting edge is how the law and this new science interact. So, for example, you know, we just, in this country, revised our Toxic Substances Control Act, which you maybe remember learning about. So in that law, there's a provision that doesn't require but encourages the Environmental Protection Agency to use non-animal alternatives whenever possible. So that may mean, and I hope it means, that as a society, we will start to use these more and more. And that's good, as I said, for several reasons. The main reasons being the ethical, moral reasons of moving away from using animals whenever you can, and also the scientific reasons of getting the best science you can. Incidentally, on the whole, working with these non-animal systems is likely to be a lot cheaper than working with animals. I mean, think about it. It's expensive to house animals, to breed animals. They need to be treated well because you have to have a very high humane standard when you use animals in the lab. You don't need to do that with cells. They're not sentient. They're not alive.
Right. So it sounds like with all of these different projects... there also are positive externalities. So an organ on a chip sounds like something that might benefit society that might not have come to pass as quickly had there not been a moral impetus to find an alternative to animal testing.
Well, yeah, and I think that brings up a really good point, and it's one of the fun things that we get to do here. We get to really show why the science is pushing us in that direction and encourage people to act to make that happen. So none of these things are going to happen just because they're the right thing to do.
Yeah.
They're going to happen because the science is better, the economics fall in our way, and there's a strong moral and ethical push. And that's one thing, a fun thing about public service is you can bring those all together, package those together, and try to get people to act.
So I'd like to package this story together. We're approaching the end of this podcast. So with the final question, asking you to reflect about your motivations, why it's been of interest to you to advance the public interest through your career in law, through pro bono work, to moving into public health, advancing the public interest in the classroom, and also in the lab and in the field with nuclear power plants. Why has it been important to advance the public interest, and what do you hope at the end of the day, after your career has concluded, what do you hope to have accomplished by that point through all of your energy, input, and effort that you've put into your career in public health and in law?
Well, I would say the first thing to point out is that it's important in anyone's career to make sure that you're moving forward, even if you're just moving forward a very small amount.
Right.
So we can't all make major leaps. I don't anticipate that I'm going to win the Nobel Prize, and I don't anticipate that I'm going to be nominated for a Supreme Court position. But I can do some good every day by being involved in public service. So that's the first thing. But the second thing that, you know, we haven't talked about, and one of the reasons I'm glad you're here, is that one of the ways that I get to act in public service is by having students who care about what's going on in the public and want to make the world a better place. And that is a great thing about being in a university or in any position where you're an educator, because you can teach people who are students who really care about these issues. And to me, that is going to be my greatest contribution.
And that has been Dr. Paul Locke, Associate Professor at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, an attorney admitted into multiple states, the law professor, the former Deputy Director of Trust for America's Health, the Board of Directors for the Council on Radiation Protection and Measurement, and a professor who speaks about his work in public service as doing good every day, where he has students whom he guides into public health and sees positive ripples across society as the students go out and advance his work in public health. He sees his ability to work on reducing animal testing in the labs as a means of ameliorating suffering, inspiring a new scientific innovation, and creating results that are ethical that can benefit society. And then he also speaks about his work with nuclear power and how nuclear power can be a safe alternative that will not threaten that will ameliorate climate change and not threaten our public health, and can still be a sustainable solution for energy in the future. So, Paul, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us today. And so thank you for joining us.
Thank you for letting me do this. And I look forward to hearing the podcast.
And this has been episode 150 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. Remind you to subscribe at publicinterestpodcast.com. Listen on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Blueberry, Player FM, Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn. And should you wish to contact Dr. Locke, you can call 240-630-0380, and that voicemail will be emailed to him. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.